Here's a little something off the request line from Liberty Island. We're gonna squeeze some New Year's juice from you, Big Apple. It's one of my all-time favorite. I always love that. It used to be You're Cruising with KIND on Hit 102.9.
Sonata. Good. Come on, you.
Everybody, good evening, good Christmas, good New Year's. It is officially that time now, and you are listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. Folks,
hello.
I'm your host, Michael Feenan.
I'm your other host, Aaron Hill. How you doing, Michael?
Who's the other host?
You.
Well, but I'm the host. If you're the other host, there has to be an other host.
You're the other host.
So I'm the host and the other host?
And I'm the other host.
So it's like a Feenan sandwich, because that's gotten people in trouble before. Just saying. Folks, you're listening to the season finale of season 2. I hope you've enjoyed the ride and learned a bunch of stuff along the way.
It's mind-blowing. For real. Like, just, yeah.
Good job. You're not getting a raise. I don't know what else to tell
you. You told me
you
were going to double my salary.
You know what? How about this? If we make it through this episode relatively successfully, I'll triple your salary.
Done.
Okay, but only if I can quadruple mine.
Done.
Okay. Actually, that's a really bad idea, because I spend money on this show, so I'm like negative. So if I quadrupled a negative, that...
I think it ends up as a positive, doesn't it?
No.
That's if you... It's to the fourth power.
I think this ends up bad for me. No matter how I look at it. Folks, you are listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. I said this is our season finale, and what we're going to be talking about tonight is a review of our top 3 episodes of all time. I thought that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I thought about maybe doing like we did last season, which was kind of a roundup of and review of our season and how we've done, and kind of some more logistical notes just about the show. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at our list of goals for season 2.
Yeah.
And I'm proud to say we achieved a couple of them. We didn't achieve many of them. Not for lack of trying in many cases. We did actually put a lot of effort into several of them, but it's one of those things where sometimes your reach exceeds your grasp, and that's okay. We'll catch up on those in season 3.
I want to say thank you to everyone who has shared this with someone that they know, because our listener numbers are climbing. And that's awesome.
So just to kind of give you an idea about that, I said we're going to be reviewing our top 3 episodes of all time. That's over both season 1 and season 2. However, the way that math works out is all 3 episodes are from season 2.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show how much folks who have been sharing the show and you know, liking us on iTunes or whatever, giving us a review and Spotify, that really does help us. And if you feel so inclined, please take the time to do that. Also, take the time to stop by our sponsors over at NewCloud at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. They will take care of your mapping needs and illustrations, interactive maps, They'll make you a braille map. They'll make you a map illustration, whatever you need. So run by there. Let them know you appreciate them sticking their neck out for us. Outside of that, where else can they find us, Aaron?
You should check us out on, I don't know, maybe Twitter, Facebook.
Maybe.
We're on those places. Our URL is Twitter and Facebook.com/DrunkenUX. And occasionally we post like not so secret behind the scenes shots of whatever we're doing while we're recording or not recording on Instagram.com/DrunkenUX podcast. And we always love it when you come over to our Slack channel and tell us what to drink.
No, that's a good point. We haven't had a good drink recommendation in a while, so that's
The last I remember was the Basil Hayden, right?
It was either the Basil Hayden or one of the mixed drinks or something, something like that. I'm not sure, which one that would have fallen under at this point. But somebody jump on and give us a recommendation for something new that we can try next season.
Jump on at drunkenux.com/slack for the sign up link.
Absolutely. Please tell me you're in the campfire, man.
Doo-doo.
Ooh, nice. See, I had a nice glass last time. You're in your nice glass this time. I like it.
My My liquor cabinet is like cleared out from Thanksgiving and I haven't had a chance to restock. So I am appropriately, I think, tapping into the Lagavulin 16 again. Got about 2/5 of the bottle left, I think. Not that much.
I'm turning you into the Scotch man, aren't I? Slowly but surely.
This one's been interesting. I think I like the, what was the other one I had? The double cherry oat, Balvenie. The Balvenie double wood.
Yeah.
That one was really good.
Balvenie's good.
It's
hard to go wrong with Balvenie, quite frankly. I'm trying something totally new tonight. Anok. I've seen it. It's been at the liquor store for a while, and that's not how it looks like it's spelled. But it's pronounced Anok.
It looks like it's A-N-C-N-O-C.
Yeah. It's more like Anknock. Anknock. Anok. It's a Highland Scotch. It's so far I'm enjoying. It's very affordable. I think it was about $53, something like that, for the 12-year. Highlands, I've said before, tend to be lighter. This one's got some really strong vanilla and malty on the nose, especially. Like the vanilla and the malt hits you really hard in the nose. In the mouth, you get something sort of citrusy, but not like a sweet citrus. More like maybe something towards not quite a lime, not quite a lemon, but. Just away from the sweet side of citrus.
Okay.
A little bit of like a cherry blossom kind of flavor and more of that vanilla. And it's light, but it's definitely even a little bit of like chocolatey finish to it. It's very nice.
Nice.
Folks, I want to talk about a quick thing. I was having troubles with a particular service I subscribe to, and I was struggling with part of the interface. Because that interface wasn't working, and the interface was giving me error codes. And so I proceeded to try to figure out what the problem was. I couldn't. I ended up Googling the error codes. I found a couple references that weren't close enough to my use case, and they recommended solutions that, like, wouldn't work. So here I am being presented with these error codes, and I can't do anything with them. They don't mean anything. And I thought that was kind of a good sort of reminder and opportunity. If you're a developer, you're building an application, and we've all done this. I'm guilty of it. I've done this. Write meaningful error messages. Messages. Your users don't know your codes. And the funny part about this to me was I looked at that code, and I know exactly what happened. I got the worst code. I got the code that says, an unknown error happened. It's like, you fell to the bottom of that if-else loop, and you fell into that else bucket, and you fell into it hard and face first. Because the error code was like 10100. Like, that's not a real error code. that's not a thing.
That's funny.
I don't know. Nielsen Norman wrote an article. This goes back almost 18 years. I think this article came out in like 2001, where they talked about error message guidelines and applications and websites. And everything they wrote is just as true today as it was then. Because your users, like I happen to be a technical user. I saw the error code and I actually was able to debug the problem on my own. And I wish we could write tools in a way that never happened. But realistically, I know that's not possible. Like there's always that bizarre else case that's going to happen. But... It also feels like you could do a lot more in those situations. Like, even if it was saying, you know what, here's what it isn't.
Right.
You know, we ran into a problem. You know, we were able to do X, Y, and Z, but we failed when we tried to do, you know, Q. I don't know.
Yeah.
What was the last error code you wrote, Aaron?
Like, in like an exception block or something?
And yeah, just anything.
Probably, I did a not implemented error earlier today. I was, I made some subclasses and I needed to make sure that a method would, you know, drop a not implemented error if you didn't define it.
And so you were in that case passing a genuine like HTTP 501. Is that?
Oh no, this is this is actually for like a console task. You mean when you say error code? You mean like for HTTP status?
Well, I mean any of it really. You know.
Yeah.
Any of it works.
I'm not even sure. It's been a while. Usually the error codes that I'm issuing are either like a 500 or a 404 or sometimes a 401. Just depends.
And you know what? I'll throw in the show notes, if you're not familiar with HTTP status codes, I'll throw a link to a bunch of them. Because you may be surprised with the number of status codes there are. And a lot of the times, errors that you have in an application, you don't need to make some kind of weird custom error code for. You could actually throw an HTTP status code and say something like, you know, 400s are great because 400s represent client errors. And so sometimes maybe that's a 405 method not allowed. Maybe that's something like, you know, a 408 on an API call. That's a request timeout. You can use those to actually prop up the message that gets sent to the browser. And even if you need to customize it, like maybe you know that this timeout is a problem. Like there's maybe there's some latency in the system that causes this and it's a technical issue you can't resolve. And so you issue a 408 to the browser and then you display to the user, this is like a 401-ABC. And then you link that in your own documentation so they can click on it and go see exactly what that means. It means, hey, this part of our infrastructure timed out, try back in 30 seconds. It's not your fault, whatever.
Right.
You can do a lot of that. I think that's it's pretty useful. But in this particular problem, though, was, you know, in their codes, they were just issuing the codes like, hey, it failed. Here's a code. Nielsen Norman's advice for writing good error codes came down to five very simple things. First, be explicit. Say exactly what's happening. Human-readable language. We're going to review one of our top episodes here in a little bit, and there's a point for this. But the idea is, I'm a technical guy. I was able to decode some stuff and infer some stuff, but most people aren't that way. Most people need things spelled out to them, so tell them. You know, the easy ones are things like, well, your login and username were wrong. That was an error I was getting as part of this problem I was having, was that my login and password were incorrect. That was a lie. That is not the problem that was happening. It was a consequence of the problem, but it was giving me the wrong error. Polite phrasing, that's an interesting one, but I like it. It's basically saying, don't, you know, say like, you issued, and the one they use is illegal command. Because the phrase illegal carries a weight to it, you know?
Right, yeah. Like illegal means like criminal.
Right, yeah. And so it's like, don't, especially like when it isn't the user's fault, like errors that aren't the user's fault, don't use a vocabulary that implies fault. Precise descriptions. This is, I think, very similar to explicit, if you ask me, but the way they describe it is, don't use vague generalities such as syntax error.
I remember seeing the words syntax error when I was a kid, you know, like in DOS feedback and everything, and thinking that it was a really neat word because it used like a Y and an X, but being like completely clueless about what it meant other than like what I kind of guessed. Like it was like, okay, I think it's, I typed something wrong here.
It also didn't give constructive advice.
Right. Right.
That's the other key one. And I think that's the most important one for the user interface side of things is once a user hits that error, tell them what they can do about it.
Right.
And if they fall into that else trap, that last condition where you don't know what happened, give them a protocol to follow. Give them a way to contact support. Give them a way to send information that will help them, you know, whether that's a stack trace or some kind of console logging or anything. An error is an opportunity to communicate, so use it.
Yeah.
So that's my thing. That's my spiel. I wanted to go on about that because I was pretty pissed off earlier, quite frankly. go write some good error codes, folks, or improve error codes that you have. If you have any neat error codes or you think you've got a good implementation, be sure to let us know. I'd love to share that out to folks. So if you've come across a good try-catch block or something like that or a good exception throw, I would love to see your process to that and your process to documenting it for users. Because I think that's the thing where – that's the place where we really fall apart.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, top three episodes.
What's number one?
I'm not going to tell you yet.
Or number, sorry. What's number three?
We're going to start from number three. I wish I could treat you like an audience and be like, what's your guess? But you literally can see what we're talking about here. So number three, the number three most popular episode comes from February 4th of this year. So it's had a little while to simmer. Don't worry. but that was episode 29, Stop Making Crappy Forms. So that was where we went into talking about form UX and all the problems that come along with form design and the way people have built, you know, checkout forms or contact forms and things like that. Turns out, popular topic, and I understand why, because I mean, I don't know if there's anything I build more of that I get more frustrated with than like contact forms and lead forms.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like if you're integrating, yeah. Right? I don't know how much integration you do, but
forms are such, like, they're more important, I think, than a lot of content, because I mean, a lot of content is just fluff, let's be honest. It's marketing fluff or just general presentation fluff. It's not actual content. But like, forms are different because they're the opportunity for the user to connect with you. And so it's really, really important that you get that right. And there's so many ways to fuck it up.
I think the good thing about this show being one of our top ones is that all things being equal, form usability hasn't really changed a ton over, certainly not the last year, but let alone the last 10 years. Form usability has really been kind of solid and straightforward. And even through all of the revolutions of Ajax and validation and autocomplete and autofill, like most of the general rules are still, I think, very much the same, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that like as we add more features, it adds new opportunities to pass or fail. and like autocomplete's a great example. Or like how, hey Michael, have you ever had a time when your form is auto, or when you, actually I think this is probably form fill, like a browser feature and not autocomplete specifically. I've had my birth date show up for my middle name before, and I had my street address show up for my organization field one time.
Oh, and you inevitably have problems with like address 1, address 2. And we've talked about that, I think, in that episode about that exact problem of can we stop having 2 lines of addresses? Just put a fucking text box in there. People know how to give you their address. But yeah, that's one where stuff gets always gets flipped around. Or
right.
Yeah, I've had my email gets stuck in weird fields sometimes, and I don't always know, like, I don't know why, and, you know, I understand that it's just a case of autofill in that situation, but it's definitely something that I wish we could get better at. You know, the thing, and something I've thought about with autofill in particular is, why aren't we better at this yet? Why is it so, like, as an example, when I go buy something now, browsers have gotten this feature where Chrome has it, I'm pretty sure Firefox has it, where they will save your credit card information.
Right.
And so when they see something that looks like, hey, enter your credit card, you can click the they put a little icon in the field and it'll say, and then, do you want to autofill this? One? And they ask you for like your CVC, right?
Right. Yeah.
And generally, my experience with that has been it works.
Yeah.
That's
me too.
A browser level feature. That's something that the browser has implemented to try to intelligently. They are the ones that are storing that data and all of that. So theoretically, that's been encrypted and is stored somewhere on your machine where it can't be decoded without, you know, your CVC and some other information. Mm-hmm. But why have we not gotten past that with things like mailing address? Why do I have to put that in at every single site I go to buy something?
Oh, I mean, if you on Chrome, I think it will attempt to autofill the form. Like once you start typing your name in, mine pops up with a little like pop-up list that it says like a couple different name and addresses. And then I click the one I want and then it will attempt to fill in the rest of the fields. That's how I get like the my birth date for
yeah, but
the street address.
I want it smarter than that. I want it to be a spec. I want a mailing address form spec so that just like what the browser does with my credit card number, it can do with my mailing address. And so that,
that, like, would be cool.
If I give it my mailing address once and it, you know, just like, you know, all these sites do it. Cards Against Humanity does it. We mentioned them in that episode. Amazon does it. Coffee AM does it. Everybody has got this thing now where you type in your address and then they send it off to a validation service API and they come back and that's where they'll come back and say, like, does this address match yours? And usually, like, your city name is in all capital letters and they've added, like, the the four code to the end of your zip code, but it's your address. So
I had a, previous job, we had a service like that where you typed in your address and then it would do a lookup. And then it would come back and tell you, like, the most correct, like, with the full zip and everything.
So let me store that in the browser, flag it as this is my full, complete, and correct mailing address. And let me design a form as a developer that says, if the user has that, when they hit my checkout page, give them an opportunity just to just say, use my stored address. Boom. Click it once. And then, because the autofill's buggy. The autofill gets things wrong. The autofill can be tricked based on whatever the checkout, not tricked, but you know, it can make mistakes, basically.
Right.
That feels like a huge opportunity for what I would see as, like, one of the most onerous form problems, which is, like, checkout pages. When you streamline checkout, that's, you know, that makes money. You know, when you streamline checkout, people convert quicker. They, you know, they... they do the action you want them to do. If you put seven fields in front of them, they're less likely to complete that task. So that seems that's one area I wish we would improve in.
Usually when they have too many fields, a lot of times because the data is getting dumped into a CRM of some kind. Really, I mean, if the people are just buying something, like, let them do what they think they're doing and don't store their data because that's crappy.
There's an article over at HubSpot we'll have linked from Kristen Baker. It's Form UX, How to Design a User-Friendly Form. It's a good refresher on a lot of the stuff we brought up in episode 29. One thing I will say, she touches on a few things like autofill that's good. Ideas like keeping your form short. These ideas that aren't new, we certainly talked about in that episode. She's got some other ideas about things like using placeholders as labels. And the way that you go about flagging, like, inline error handling and stuff, that goes a little against the grain of what I think common UX research tells us. But I think it's a good case to read it and always remember that sometimes you do need to question your research and check it against your own users and make sure that it's true. Because your user base may actually be very well served by things like inline validation. You know what
I'd like to see is we've all been doing this form thing on the internet long enough now collectively that I think we know the different kinds of ways people like to have input fields appear when they're being validated. And why don't we have a similar spec for input fields where, like, you have an attribute that's like error state and then it's like a collection of CSS styles or I don't know, like, basically every field needs to have a label to make it accessible and it needs to have the field itself. And then generally people like to add an error message and they like to add maybe some, like, styling changes to it. And we do that through JavaScript right now, but really there's no reason why this should just be something where there's just attributes on the form, like not WCAG, but W3C could say input fields now have these properties.
Right.
And then those properties are used to handle these cases. I think we could all say that these are things that are consistently used.
Right, because we have a super basic one now, right? And this is one that I still see way too much, which is, like, if I'm using my phone for something and I'm using a form, so a great use case of this is, like, getting a two-factor authentication.
Right.
Two-factor authentication, six-digit number. If I'm tapping into that field to enter that button, don't send me to my keyboard. You literally, all you have to do is say, this is a type number. And then the phone will give me a number, a 9 key to use. I don't have to tap out of my keyboard. We don't type our fields properly. But one thing I've found over, you know, the last, what is it, 13 years of web development that I've been doing, you know, designers, when you work with another designer, they love making custom error states, custom error messages, you know, inevitably. Yeah. And then the marketing people love the branding of it. So I could make the argument that, hey, let me let the browser control the behavior the way the browser is meant to control it. But that's often a hill that you don't want to die on as well. Like, of all the fights you have to have when you're employing a design, that's one that just, man, it's a war of attrition a little bit. But yeah, I see what you're driving at, and I would absolutely agree.
Look at tables. Like, tables have self-padding, self-spacing, border, height, right? Width? A couple other traits? All these different attributes that describe what it looks like. And why can't we have that for input fields? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I think we definitely need...
They did add disabled. That was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're worried at all about whether or not you have a crappy form, let me just tell you, Tag Manager, Google Tag Manager, is a great resource for figuring that out. There's an article I'll link. It's a little bit old now. It's from Simo Ahava, who is somebody that I read religiously. I love his work, and he's brilliant at Tag Manager. But he's got an article about how to build a form abandonment tracker in Tag Manager.
Yeah. Oh, so, that's cool.
Yeah, so what it does is you create a listener, and that listener just runs, and it sits on the page, and it listens for form interactions, so like key-ins to form fields. And as it's doing that, it starts a variable that keeps track of which form they're going into. And if they leave the page before hitting the submit button, what he does is there's an on before unload event that fires that sends a Google Analytics event that says,
okay,
here's where they left. So you can see how much of your form they filled out before they gave up. It's an incredibly good way to figure out, like, do you have a high point, so to speak, in your form? You know, something you need to sand down to smooth out. That's a great way to measure how good your forms are performing.
I like that. Yeah.
So that's crappy forms. That was crappy forms. I hope that's a little extra. I'm not gonna revolutionize the world here, but go check out Simo's article on form abandonment tracking. I think that's a good growth from there. Read Kristen's article over at HubSpot and let us know what you've done over the past year to improve your forms, because that's something that, you know, I think we're all always looking to do. Episode number 2 on the list. It comes to you all the way from May 27th. So,
this one's not surprising.
Not surprising.
This is
episode 37.
This is a hot button.
The Gutenberg accessibility audit is in. This was this was when Rachel Cherry joined us.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this was big news then, and I mean it's still a large and continuing discussion now. First and foremost, I want to point out WordPress 5.3 came with a bunch of explicit accessibility improvements.
Right.
That's nice to see. Like, and they called those out. A lot of those were the work of the accessibility group, council, board, whatever they call that within the WordPress organization. But they pushed out, and there's a whole list of these in the release notes, and we'll link those certainly in the show notes. But for instance, and like one that I saw immediately, buttons no longer have a box shadow. If you've looked in WordPress now, the old filled buttons...
Oh, they're like flat design?
They've gone to a hard flat design that is much higher contrast, much starker. It looks much more buttony, I think. It was something...
Weird.
That was one of those things, like, I guess, even hardly process the box shadow on those buttons. But once I saw it without them, it's like, that's better. it just stood out way, way more.
Yeah.
Darker tables and meta box borders have been introduced for a better hierarchy between interface elements.
Yeah.
That separation is now very clear. So with all of that is wrapped up in the point they've got stronger color contrasts on form fields and buttons.
Mm-hmm.
That's seen throughout the interface. Focus styles on form fields and buttons. This mm-hmm. was to help address issues where people were losing track of where they were tabbing throughout the interface. We have content behavior on text zoom.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a new navigation mode. I'm going to read this whole thing here. A new navigation mode has been introduced to the block editor in WordPress 5.3. Now you can move from block to block by using the tab key. You can also use the arrow keys to navigate between blocks. Once you reach the block you want to edit, you can hit enter to enter edit mode by hitting the enter key. That seems redundantly phrased. Use the escape key to move back to navigation mode. So that's a long way of saying that they've really leaned into the problem with keyboard controls on the block editor.
Right.
That was something that was a core complaint at launch, was that keyboard accessibility, quite frankly, sucked.
I think one thing that I think is really incredible about this is that, like, so these changes all came about as a result of the audit, right? Mostly.
Yeah. I would like to say yes. I think that Rachel's work on the audit was phenomenal. And I think it definitely brought a much brighter light onto something that other people were trying to cast light on. Nobody likes to bolt on accessibility after the fact, but it is something that can be done. And as long as that is part of the strategy, at least there is a strategy. Better than nothing. Mm-hmm. There's an article over at the make.wordpress.org site for accessibility from the accessibility group. They have not stood still, and I want to impress this upon people. Like, that's one thing. Like, where we were when we reviewed the accessibility audit back in May, progress has been made. 5.3 made progress, but the accessibility working group is still doing a lot of stuff. They've instituted what will be they're working on the date still. But they're going to have Global WordPress Accessibility Day, which I'm presuming will be some kind of like either brainstorming / skunks working / boot camping of accessibility features for WordPress, hopefully.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm going to read this as well. This was a quote from that post. We agreed to explore the idea of creating documentation for baseline accessibility testing procedures and expectations, which I think that's important because it goes back. One thing that Rachel talked about in episode 37 was WordPress has said, you know, our standard is we push out WCAG 2.0 compliant code, but they were not doing that. And I think that statement is sort of the... While that's not what it says they're going to do, I think it's sort of that underlying foundation, having the documentation, having the testing, and having the expectations outlined is sort of step one, right, to enforcing that technique with future development. At least it is, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
There's one big piece of information I want folks to go check out, and it's from Matt Ryan, who works over at Carleton College. He's got a post up at his site's empathicinterfaces.com/Guten. Don't remember it. Go check out the show notes. It'll be in there. He's got some information posted there. One, he did some usability research on Gutenberg and posted their results on that because they are rolling out Gutenberg WordPress as their new CMS at Carleton College. So they needed to test it.
In the slide deck, he has a giant trash dumpster labeled Gutenberg accessibility, and it's on fire, and there's a fireman putting it out, and the fireman's labeled WP Campus.
Yeah, there are strong feelings in this community. What they've done is he went out, did research, and published those results. 7 pages, and the slides that you're looking at are from a presentation he gave at High Ed Web, which we've mentioned here before, because again, college. But there's good information in there about what the problems are so that you can see if you can work around them or if they will impede anything that you're trying to do, even if it's just personally. Like, keep in mind, a lot of people run websites just for themselves, and you don't have to hold yourself to strict 508 standards necessarily. But, you know, you may have needs or have requirements that you do have to meet because you're hard of vision or you have motor control issues or whatever. So he's outlined some of that there. The really interesting thing, though, that he's done that I think you should go check out is he's created a WordPress plugin called Guten Tolerance. Gut Intolerance.
I didn't catch the pun at first, but the logo for it is the words Gut Intolerance kind of drawn out in some kind of jam on pieces of bread.
Yeah.
It's pretty clever.
Intolerance. Yeah. So what it does, and again, I'm sorry I'm going to read this, but it's because it's written better than I could say it off the top of my head. This plugin makes Gutenberg easier on new users by labeling many interface elements that otherwise only appear on hover and modifying the display of other elements that cause confusion to novice users. So basically, mm-hmm. he took all of the research he did, all the user research, all of those outcomes, and said, okay, I'm going to build a plugin to address those things. At least the ones that were easily tackled. And so you can install this and run it, and it'll modify the interface slightly so that it's still Gutenberg, but it addresses right. some of those issues that users had. Some of those issues that maybe are being, like 5.3 I mentioned, have resolved some of those hover states and things and focus states and things like that. So I would love to see maybe, I'm hoping, and I would probably be right in assuming that the accessibility team for WordPress has seen this plugin already, and they are very likely looking at how it's dealing with some of that to maybe roll in those kinds of features. This is one of those plugins I look at as the goal of this plugin is to eliminate itself, right?
Yes.
Like,
that's good.
The best outcome for this plugin is for it to say, no, I'm not needed anymore. That's how it knows it's done its job.
Right, right.
So go check that out. It's at empathicinterfaces.com/Guten, G-U-T-E-N, from Matt Ryan over at Carleton College. Okay, drum roll. Give me drum roll.
This is number one.
Give me drum roll. Drum roll. Drum roll.
Hold on.
The number one episode was from March 18th, episode 32, so we go back a little ways. The 10 UX commandments. And
I was not that surprised that this was the number one because the title is super clickbaity.
Okay, well, that's fair. And I kind of lifted it from the original article, and I admit that.
Right, right.
So the thing that I do want to point out about it is even as the number one episode, it was number one by a lot. It beat number two. Substantially, I'll leave it at that, but it beat number two substantially.
I think part of the reason might have been that the author of the original article, Phil Delavand, I think he shared our tweet with us, didn't he?
Oh, that may be, yeah.
I seem to recall, maybe I'm wrong,
love but that
I seem
amplification. To recall that
happening. Yeah.
So our idea here was we're going to rerun these, right? We're going to read through them real fast. Yeah. There were 10 commandments. We're not going to give you an 11th commandment because, quite frankly, I think he did a fantastic job of outlining some of the most important mm-hmm. high points of UX, and we're not going to try to improve upon that, but we've got a few extra ideas to throw in here on each of these, and we're going to run through them pretty quickly, so I apologize, but first and foremost, number one, you are not the user. I think the best and very recent case of this that I wanted to throw out there was the idea of the Tesla Cybertruck.
Oh, the video clip of him throwing the metal ball through the window and then doing it again to the rear window and it breaking both is just like perfect.
The meme I enjoyed was, I don't know if you remember some of the early renderings of the Tesla truck that had gotten out, and it compares, it's like, you know, the what we were promised, what we got kind of meme. But
right.
he did, and this is not the most perfect example of this commandment, mind you, but it's this idea that he designed a truck that was not designed for users. I think Tesla explicitly wanted to limit the appeal of this vehicle, and so they intentionally went with an abrasive design to moderate the production of the truck.
Isn't there a name for that when you it's a certain kind of good that they intentionally like try to sell to a smaller market to create forced scarcity.
A pilot program?
No, like the Supreme brand and Air Force Ones. They're both like that. I'll look it up.
That was what came to mind though for me when I was thinking about, you know, you are not the user, because it's a fairly straightforward. The idea behind you are not the user is that just because I do something one way doesn't mean other people do it another way. So this idea that he built something that wasn't designed for the way, you know, it's not a truck for the normal person who drives a truck. It's not a truck that was meant for everybody to go out and get. And I think they very intentionally made it so that it would reflect what they wanted to accomplish as engineers, not what they want to sell. And I think you're going to see a second truck in pretty short order that will be much closer to what that original rendering was. Because I don't think that original rendering was accidental either.
Right. Yeah. That car looks like the kind of thing that you'd see on like a 1980s poster, like a real vaporwave looking thing.
Yeah.
Number two, you shall consider Uthers superior to yourself.
That's and not just how you a say reminder, that word.
Uthers? U-T-H-E-R-S?
Oh, you misspelled it. Yeah, I think you put a typo in there.
Uthers. No, it's Uthers. It's users plus other.
That's
like other users.
Ridiculous.
I didn't make it up. I'm just reading the cues, man.
I'm pretty sure I said that same thing the first time around. This actually, I think, throws back, though, to the warmer topic about the error codes and stuff, and this idea that writing, you know, if you're writing error codes that are only meaningful to you, then you're presuming that the user understands that, and they don't.
Yeah,
you know, you're putting yourself above them. You're saying, "Well, I know what that error code means, so that's all that really matters." They'll tell me, but they don't. A lot of times, a lot of times, a user will get frustrated and just leave if that's the case. Number three, you shall not kill the research. Honestly, I think this one's simple, and I don't know that there's anything really to add except that what this means is invest in your analytics. And like we said back with the throwback to making Don't Make Crappy Forms, the episode about crappy forms, spend the time, set up that tag manager tag, and track your abandonment. You have no reason to ignore the data that you could be pulling in that could give you valuable ways to change the way you approach stuff and make more money. Yeah.
Number four, you shall not base your judgment on assumptions.
This, you know, the not basing your judgment on assumptions, the simple phrase, and I don't think we use this in episode 32, is the test but verify mantra.
Right.
Or trust. It's not test. It's trust but verify, right?
Right.
So you have your assumptions. You have the what other research tells you. But be willing to question those assumptions and take the time to just do a little extra work sometimes and make sure that it's right. Especially in cases where you think your audience may not be quite like the audience that was reflected in whatever research was done 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
I just had, you know, what came up recently in a conversation was the hamburger menu.
What about it?
There's a lot of, not a lot, there's some research starting to come out that says the hamburger menu works and is effective. There's some research that says the hamburger works, but only in the sense that it's better than alternatives. Because of, you know, this goes back to Jacob's Law. Everything goes back to Jacob's Law. The fact of the matter is, most sites use a hamburger menu. So if you do something different, you're actually...
Doing
the hamburger menu isn't great, but it's worse doing something different.
This whole time, you're saying hamburger menu, and I'm literally picturing, like, a restaurant menu with hamburgers.
Oh, no, I had that conversation, too. I told them, don't, if you are a restaurant, don't use the word menu to label your actual site menu.
God, what's wrong with
you? You are sleepless, but I'm going to pretend like you've had too much Lagavulin, because...
Yeah. Indeed.
Number five, you shall not covet features. You know what this means? You know what I need? I need a sound effect every time we say this.
like an echoing God voice.
Something. Yeah, I think we need to nail this home. This is our mantra.
Do less, butter.
Yeah, don't go after every new shiny thing. That's just an easy one, and it hasn't changed since day one. But it really, I think, you know, I apply Do Less Better to so many things, and just controlling the amount of work you're letting yourself take on is one of those. So, yeah, Do Less Better. Number six. I said number five. You say number six.
You shall ask why relentlessly.
Don't worry, I do.
Why?
Because it helps me work better.
Why?
Because it ensures that I'm doing the right work for the right reasons.
Why?
Because I get paid money to produce results, and I want to make sure that the value is there.
Why?
Because if I'm producing the right results, it means my users are getting what they expect out of my website.
Why?
Because if my users are getting what they expect out of the website, it means my clients are getting what they expect out of our service.
When?
Down the road.
I think you got the idea.
And I seriously do. Like, that has been, I think, maybe one of the most true and straight as an arrow components of my work over the last 6 months, is I've gotten just religious about questioning things. And
yeah,
questioning things, I think you don't have to do it the way Aaron did it. There are ways to ask why that are subversive, isn't the right word, but
around the
question,
roundabout,
or ways to, you know, because it's a lot of the times the reason you have to ask why is because if a request is coming to you that doesn't make business sense, it's sometimes not professional to question that of somebody, but you can get them to question it on their own if you can lead them into that. It's a little, you know, psychological or whatever, but once you've learned how to do it, and once you've, you know, gotten used to knowing what business value is and what has worked in the past and what has made money. And so learning how to ask why and ask it in the right ways for the right people can be very empowering to getting yourself to do the right work. Because I don't want to spend my time. I can spend 2 weeks working on a feature that gets unraveled in one meeting with the right person because somebody didn't clarify something or didn't approach the goal the right way. Number six is definitely one of my favorites, but only behind number seven. You shall build accessible, inclusive products. There's an upcoming change to WCAG 2.1 you should know about. It starts, there's an article at instructiondesign.org, again, linked in the show notes, Fitts Law, the importance of size and distance in UI design. See, hey, we don't always refer to Jacob's Law. Fitts Law is all about how big something is and how quickly you can get to it.
Right.
The reason this matters, there's a new standard in WCAG 2.1, which I believe is statute 255, that deals with target size. And I've brought this up to a lot of people because folks don't know this is a thing. It wasn't in 2.0. It's new in 2.1. And what they're doing is they're setting a minimum hitbox size for elements of 44 CSS pixels. It's going to be incredibly important to pay attention to the size of your targets. Now, I will note, this is AAA compliance.
Right.
Most legal regards only require AA, but
okay,
this is still something that, you know, it's still a standard to hold yourself to. And
so how big is that?
It's 44 pixels. Come on.
But I mean, like, how big is...
How many pixels are on your device right now?
Five.
Okay, well, we need more of those. No.
There might be more than five, but there's at least five.
Yeah, so I use the phrase CSS pixels. A CSS pixel is not like a screen pixel, because we have, you know, phones with high density displays, right? Retina displays,
right.
MacBooks with Retina displays. And so the idea of what a pixel is has changed a little bit. A CSS pixel, though, is a set size. It results to roughly 1/96th of an inch.
Mm-hmm.
For our overseas folks, that's roughly a quarter of a millimeter, just over. So for 44 pixels, if your minimum hitbox size is 44 by 44 pixels, you're coming in somewhere in the area of about a half inch.
Yeah.
I think I said earlier it was like I eyeballed it at roughly the size of a quarter of an inch.
So 48 divided by 96 would be a half inch.
Yeah, give or take. That sounds about right.
So 44 divided by 96 would be just under a half inch.
Yeah, what was that? 88 96ths? That's pretty darn close. It's just a hair under.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thinking about, I mean, and that's not tiny, right? Like, if you hold up in front of you roughly what a just under half an inch square is, that's big on a web page, especially when you think about the way we use iconography as interaction elements on devices and in space. If you've got tables of information that have things like edit, delete, copy buttons or something on them, a lot of the times those are as small as like 16 pixels. You know, they're just the size of the icon. So if you're striving for accessible, inclusive products that meet high standards, AAA standards, you're going to have to be thinking about this 44 pixel measurement. So that's one of those new rules, new changes that I think is very thoughtful in within the spec of Rule 7.
Yeah. Rule 8.
What about it?
You shall make decisions. Your children's children, children's children, children's children will be proud of.
Just children's children. You don't gotta make it more complicated than it is. go back and listen to episode 41. That was Ron Bronson's episode, right?
Right.
We were talking about dark patterns and hostile design.
Hostile design.
Hostile patterns, right. Hostile design.
Hostile patterns.
And that, I think, is sort of the classic example of that.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure in that episode we made a callback to this particular subject, because this is sort of that underlying current of, if you're building things that are designed to trick people, that are designed to get people to do things they weren't otherwise intending to do, that's not the way to do it. The way I tend to phrase this, I say this same thing, but I say it a little differently, which is, I want to make sure I'm doing things my grandmother would be proud of. You know, and that's the way I look at it. But I think the same is true either direction there. Number 9, we're almost there. You shall steal all the best UX out there. My example of this in practice recently is actually kind of funny. At least it is to me. Mm-hmm. Popeyes and Chick-fil-A.
Right.
You know, the idea of Popeyes creating the chicken sandwich that was meant to rival Chick-fil-A, you know, they basically said, you know what, we can do that. We're a chicken place. We can make an awesome chicken sandwich. And there's no harm in that. And in fact, you know, I think probably the brand war that ensued was probably good for both of them, quite frankly.
Oh, certainly. I mean, no exposure is bad exposure, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you have, if you watch YouTube at all the different, you know, people that were doing the taste comparisons and or blind taste tests and things like that. Sorry, I watch a lot of YouTube. and then Wendy's is off there to the side saying, hey, guys, we started it. And Wendy's makes a mean chicken sandwich. Let's just be honest.
All right, number 10.
Number 10.
You shall always respect and defend users.
I'm not going to say what our example is because it's going to make me mad.
It's kind of a counterexample to this. Like, don't do it this way.
It's the example that says, here's what it looks like when you don't follow this rule.
Right. Earlier this year, we had an episode where the warmer topic was about, or maybe it was a whole show.
It's come up a couple times at this point.
Yeah. Like, Domino's got, like, sued, like, countersued?
Well, they appealed.
Or they appealed. That's what it was. Yeah, they appealed to the Supreme Court to, I think the charitable explanation you had was that they were trying to get more specific so that they could comply and know that they're complying and avoid patent trolls. Or no, accessibility trolls, usability troll. I don't know what that
means. I'm also, by saying that, I am making an excuse for them, and I am putting words in their mouth.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, at this stage, in terms of the 10th commandment, I can't defend them on it, because that's not what they said, and it's not the rationale that they actively put out there.
Occam's razor would say that it's because they're just being shitty. It's a more elaborate and strange explanation to say that it's because of the other reason.
The underlying, if you haven't caught the past episodes or kept up with the news, the underlying story is a blind user was trying to order pizza through the Domino's app, couldn't do it, tried to do it through their website, couldn't do it, filed a lawsuit. Domino's lost that lawsuit, then appealed it, and ultimately appealed it to the Supreme Court, where I can't remember what the outcome of that was. I think it was just the appeals court said Domino's was in violation of the ADA, and the Supreme Court just said, "Yeah, we're not gonna take this case."
Yeah,
the decision stands. So right. It's just a case of all Domino's had to do was in this case the number $36,000.
Oh yeah, it was not.
They'd gotten an estimate on how much they thought it would cost to make the changes required. Like for a company of that size, it was not a lot of money.
And the fact that it was so little says to me that the good faith excuse is probably bunk.
Yeah.
Even if they got sued because someone was trying to like weasel around their compliance, they made a good faith effort to fix it. So that seems like it would be defensible position. Or they would have ostensibly made a good faith effort to fix it.
So do that. Respect your users. Defend your users. Let us know how you're doing it. Folks, those are our top three episodes. You have 10 UX commandments, you have Gutenberg accessibility audit, and you have crappy forms. That's what you've listened to the most since we launched our show. Maybe in a couple more years, we'll do this again with three more that aren't these three, because I've got a feeling most of these three will keep going up. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone, to the season finale of Season 2 of Drunken UX Podcast. This has been really awesome, and I'm still amazed that we've done two seasons now. That's just kind of mind-blowing.
I'm impressed that you've kept up and just been like, screw you, I'm not doing this anymore.
I'm amazed you haven't booted me off the show, because you definitely do, like, the lion's share of the work here.
Folks, I, too, would like to make a resounding applaud to everybody who's tuned in over the year. I'm looking at my numbers right now, and I'm seeing roughly 30% growth over Season 2, which is incredible. I'm thrilled with that, and I'm looking forward to more in the future. If you want to give us a Christmas present, the best possible Christmas present you can give is give us a share, give us a like or a review in whatever app you're using right now. You can do that on Twitter or Facebook at /DrunkenUX. You can do that on Instagram at /DrunkenUXPodcast. You can get us on Slack at drunkenux.com/Slack. As always, go by the website or any of our social channels if you have show ideas, guest ideas that you want to see in Season 3 or beyond. We're already lining those up. Be sure to click our contact link on our website, and you can do all of those things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, hey, congratulations,
Eric.
It's
the end of a decade. Happy New Year.
End of the decade, end of 2 years. And to everybody out there, stick with us. Season 3, I promise, will be even bigger and better than Season 2. We have guests lined up. We have topics lined up. We have some ideas. I've got a site I'm rebuilding that I think will be cool to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, no tricks, no mystery, no trying to hide it. I have one piece of advice for you.
What's that?
For 2019, I hope you kept your personas close, but your users closer. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.